Cale Clark here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Relevant Radio and get a free phone. Don't delay. CharityMobile.com. That's CharityMobile.com. Hey, welcome back to The Faith Explained. So glad that you're with me today. I'm Cale Clark, and we're looking at our new series. It's called Bonding with James. And today we're going to look at the big three in the early Catholic Church and how influential they were, and some of their, they tangled with each other at some level. And if you're a basketball fan like me, you know that a lot of teams over the years have tried to construct a big three. They'll put three superstar players together in the hopes of being invincible. And this really, it's not just in our day, but even going back to the 1980s, I know it wasn't that long ago, but the 1980s Boston Celtics had Bird, McHale, and Robert Parrish. Then the Lakers countered with Magic Johnson, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and James Worthy. But closer to our own times, in the 2010s, there was another James, King James, LeBron James. LeBron James, Dwayne Wade, and Chris Bosh formed a super team in Miami. And just this past year, well, the Brooklyn Nets flamed out with their big three of Harden, James Harden, Kevin Durant, Kyrie Irving. They traded Harden during the season, flamed out in the first round of the playoffs. The Lakers as well, LeBron James, AD, Russell Westbrook, didn't exactly work out. But, hey, it was worth a shot. Well, one super team really did work out ultimately for the Catholic Church, and that was the big three of Peter, Paul, and James. And James was kind of, you know, maybe considered the odd man out, maybe not as important to the team, but he really was crucial, as we'll see. And just like on any basketball team, sometimes teammates don't always see eye to eye. They don't always get along, and they might have to go to a different destination for a little bit. And there were some tense moments among the big three in the Catholic dream team as well, which we'll find out in this episode. Now, you'll remember, just at the end of the last session here on The Faith Explained, I told you that I was going to share a very humorous true story about how exactly James became the Bishop of Jerusalem. And we were looking at Acts chapter 12, the Acts of the Apostles chapter 12. So if you have your Bible with you, which is always a good idea to bring with you, you can always open it up to Acts 12 and you can follow along with me if you'd like. And as I said, at the beginning of Acts chapter 12, St. Luke, who wrote Acts, it's kind of part two of his two-volume set, the Gospel of Luke and the Acts of the Apostles. In Acts chapter 12, he tells us about the death of another James, James, the son of Zebedee, the brother of the apostle John. And what he says here is that Herod had him killed by the sword. That's in the first part of the chapter. And of course, what Herod does next is he wants to go after the big cheese. He wants to go after Peter himself, the Pope, take out the general, I guess, is what he was thinking there. So this is what happened, and this is an amazing story. Peter is thrown into prison. Herod's planning on bringing him out, having him killed. But it says this, and this is Acts chapter 12, verse 6 and following. The very night when Herod was about to bring him out, Peter was sleeping between two soldiers, bound with two chains and sentries before the door, were guarding the prison. And behold, an angel of the Lord appeared, and a light shone in the cell. And he struck Peter on the side and woke him, saying, "Get up quickly." And the chains fell off his hands. And the angel said to him, "Dress yourself and put on your sandals." And he did so. And he said to him, "Wrap your cloak around you and follow me." And he went out and followed him. He did not know what was done by the angel was real, but thought he was seeing a vision. When they had passed the first and the second guard, they came to the iron gate leading into the city. It opened to them of its own accord, and they went out and passed on through one street, and immediately the angel left him. And Peter came to himself and said, "Now I am sure that the Lord has sent his angel and rescued me from the hand of Herod and from all that the Jewish people were expecting." When he realized this, he went into the house of Mary, the mother of John, whose other name was Mark, where many were gathered together and were praying. And when he knocked at the door of the gateway, a maid named Rhoda came to answer. Recognizing Peter's voice, in her joy, she did not open the gate, but ran in and told that Peter was standing at the gate. They said to her, "You are mad." But she insisted that it was so. They said, "It is his angel." But Peter continued knocking, and when they opened, they saw him and were amazed. But motioning to them with his hand to be silent, he described to them how the Lord had brought him out of the prison. And he said, "Tell this to James and to the brethren." Then he departed and went to another place. Now when day came, there was no small stir among the soldiers over what had become of Peter. And when Herod had sought for him and could not find him, he examined the sentries and ordered that they should be put to death. Then he went down from Judea to Caesarea and remained there. Okay, so humorous but not so funny, very serious consequences for those soldiers who paid with their lives. And not that it was their fault. The angel busted Peter out of prison, but it's just so comical. Peter is knocking at the door. Everybody's in the house. They're praying for him, for his safety. He's outside. Rhoda says, "Guys, Peter's at the door." "Yeah, you're crazy." And no, it's really him. Oh, maybe it's his angel. Sidebar, this also shows that in the early church, they believed in guardian angels. Okay, a lot of Christian denominations, non-Catholic groups don't believe in personal guardian angels, but the early Christians obviously did. The early church really did. And then Peter's, at the whole time, he's still knocking. He's like, "Guys, I'm really here. Don't worry about my angel. I'm here. Let me in, for goodness sake." So the whole thing is just really funny. But Peter knows, you know, hey, they'll be looking for him. He's got to get out. He's got to get on the run and move around. And so that's why Peter says, just before he leaves, "Hey, tell James about this," specifically James and all the other brethren as well. You're listening to The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio. I'm your host, Cale Clark. So there's a scholar named John Painter who said that this chapter should really be, this is the indication, how it was that James became the Bishop of Jerusalem, because Peter had to go. And Peter's the Pope. Wherever Peter is, there is the papacy. And the reason why the papacy is based in Rome is because that's where Peter ended up. That's where he last was before his martyrdom. He went from Jerusalem. He eventually went to Antioch. And that's where the believers were first called Christians, according to the Acts of the Apostles. I'll tell you more about Antioch in a second, what happened there. James had something to do with that, too. Big kerfuffle. And then eventually Peter winds up in Rome, which makes sense if you want to spread the good word of the gospel. You go to the capital of the empire. All roads lead to Rome. And so that's what John Painter says. This is how James took over. You know, who's going to take over? Now that Peter's not here, let's go with James. But there are other views. Clement of Alexandria, and Ben Witherington reports this in his book, that Clement of Alexandria said that actually after Jesus ascended into heaven, Peter, James, and John the son of Zebedee, and James, his brother, who was killed by Herod, not the James we're talking about. Peter, James, and John, the two Zebedee guys, got together after the ascension, and they said, "Look, okay, James should be the Bishop of Jerusalem." The other James, known as the quote-unquote brother of the Lord. We don't know. Eusebius, church historian of the times, he says that, well, what happened was James became the bishop after the death, the martyrdom of Saint Stephen. So however it happened, we don't really know for sure, but we do know this. This is a fact, that James did become the leader of the church in Jerusalem, which is a crucial city for the early church. It's where the church was born. It's where Jesus died. It's the center of Jewish life and praxis. And of course, that's where the resurrection happened as well. All right, so the big three on the Catholic team in the early church, Peter, talked about him. Paul, let's talk about number two. And then, of course, there is James. Let's talk about Paul for a second. Now, Paul is obviously a crucial figure in the New Testament world as well. He wrote about 40% of the New Testament with his letters. A lot more of it is about him. Luke, writing the Acts of the Apostles, Paul figures so much in that book, especially the second half. Well, one of Paul's letters is his letter to the Galatians. That might be. It might just be the first letter in the New Testament that he wrote. Maybe not. It might be 1 Thessalonians. A lot of people think that's the one. But Regardless, it's pretty early. It was written probably in the year 49 AD, before the Council of Jerusalem that James was a big part of as the Bishop of Jerusalem. But really what happened, the events that happened that Paul talks about in Galatians, this major crisis in the church, really a confrontation that happened between the first pope, Peter, and Paul. And this was kind of an ugly scene. What they were dealing with, that eventually had to be dealt with at the Council of Jerusalem. But anyways, in Galatians chapter 1, now we see this. This is what St. Paul says about James. He says this, after his conversion, Paul's recounting how he went from persecutor of the Catholic Church to propagator of the faith, how he goes from Christian killer to killer evangelist for Christ, as my friend Greg Minette likes to say. Here's what he says. When God, who was pleased to reveal his son to me so that I might proclaim him among the Gentiles, I did not confer with any human being, Paul writes, nor did I go up to Jerusalem to those who were already apostles before me, but I went away at once into Arabia, and afterwards I returned to Damascus. Then after about 3 years, so Paul has really been kind of on this extended retreat with the Lord. Then after about 3 years, Paul says, I did go up to Jerusalem to visit Cephas. That's Peter. It's his Aramaic name. It means rock. Same thing. I went up to Jerusalem to visit Cephas and stayed with him 15 days, but I did not see any other apostle except James, the Lord's brother. Okay, scholar Ben Witherington says that this took place, this visit of Paul, in the year 37 AD, just a few short years after the death of Jesus, the resurrection of Jesus. This is probably where Paul got that Corinthian creed about the resurrection appearances in 1 Corinthians 15, very ancient creed, verifying the resurrection of Christ, talks about the eyewitnesses. This is the first time that James is mentioned in the New Testament. If Galatians is that early, this is the earliest reference to James. But then again, in the next chapter, in Galatians 2, St. Paul talks about another trip he made to Jerusalem, and James comes into play there too. This happens in about the year AD 48. And Paul writes, this is in Galatians chapter 2, verses 1 through 10. Check this out. Paul writes these words. He says, then after 14 years, I went up again to Jerusalem with Barnabas, taking Titus along with me. I went up by revelation. In other words, he's saying God inspired him, the Spirit inspired him to go there. And I laid before them, but privately, before those who are of repute, the gospel which I preach among the Gentiles, lest somehow I should be running or had run in vain. So in other words, he wants to check his work. He wants the apostles to check his work. He wants to make sure that he's preaching the same gospel that they are. So he's accountable. He's not a rogue. He's not starting his own religion. Some people have suggested that Paul was the founder of Christianity. That is absolute nonsense. But Paul writes, he goes on here in Galatians 2, but even Titus, who was with me, was not compelled to be circumcised, though he was a Greek. But because of false brethren secretly brought in, who slipped in to spy on our freedom, which we have in Christ Jesus, that they might bring us into bondage. To them, we did not yield submission even for a moment, that the truth of the gospel might be preserved for you. And what's St. Paul talking about there? Well, we're going to get into this in just a second, but there were some people in the early church who wanted to say, and they were Jewish Catholics. They were of Hebrew origin. They had accepted Jesus as the Messiah, but they said, hey, any Gentiles, non-Jews coming into the church, they need to observe the ceremonial works of the law. They need to be circumcised if they're males. They all need to observe the kosher food laws. And Paul says, no, that's not the case. They don't need to do these things. So more on that in just a second. But Paul writes, he says, from those who were reputed to be something, what they were makes no difference to me. God shows no partiality. Those, I say, who were of repute added nothing to me. But on the contrary, when they saw that I had been entrusted with the gospel to the uncircumcised, just as Peter had been entrusted with the gospel to the circumcised, for he who worked through Peter for the mission to the circumcised worked through me also for the Gentiles. And when they perceived the grace that was given to me, James and Cephas and John, who were reputed to be pillars, gave to me and Barnabas the right hand of fellowship, that we should go to the Gentiles and they to the circumcised, only they would have us remember the poor, which is the very thing I was eager to do. Okay, so Paul spends a lot of time in Galatians chapter 2 saying, he's talking about those who were of repute, those who were allegedly people of repute in the church. You know, who is he talking about? He's talking about Peter, James, and John the Apostle. Okay, he says they're pillars of the church. They're of repute. But he says, hey, their standing means nothing to me. God shows no partiality. I don't care what their titles are. Now, that's a little bit of, you know, rhetorical language by Paul. Paul's being a little sensitive at this point because, you know, he's been challenged by some. A lot of people challenge Paul's authority as an apostle. He's not saying that these guys weren't really leaders in the church, but they were. They absolutely were. And so it's important to understand that James, along with Peter and the Apostle John, they're big pillars in the church, and so was Paul, because this is the new temple of God. And Ben Witherington says that this Greek word, stuloi, which is translated as pillars, again, they're supporting columns in the future temple that God is constructing, and that is the church. By the way, that same word, pillars, it's in the Old Testament. When they talk about building the tabernacle, what was the tabernacle? The mobile temple in the wilderness as the Israelites were traveling to the promised land. The very presence of God, Ark of the Covenant, all that stuff is in the tabernacle. Well, guess what? When they get to Jerusalem, they eventually build the temple, right? When the temple is built under King Solomon, guess what? It mentions the pillars. So that's where this comes from. It's also true of the eschatological temple. Now, that's a $5 word, isn't it? Eschatological. What does that mean? It has to do with the eschaton, the Greek word eschaton. That means the last things, the things of the end, the end times, okay? And everybody in the first century, they thought that when the Messiah arrived, that would mean, hey, we're living in the last days. And we still are. The last days have just been a lot more days than people thought, but we are living in the last times. Of course, the last days are here, the death, the resurrection of Christ ushers in this new age, the last age. And hey, we're just now waiting for the return of the Messiah, the new heavens, the new earth, the final judgment, all of that stuff. But we are living in the last days. The eschatological temple is being built. Now, in the book of Revelation, here on the Faith Explained program on Relevant Radio, we recently did a big series on the book of Revelation. You can find it in the Relevant Radio archives for this show on the Faith Explained page on relevantradio.com. And in Revelation chapter 3, verse 12, Jesus said this, "If you conquer, I will make you a pillar in the temple of my God. You will never go out of it. I will write on you the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the new Jerusalem that comes down from my God out of heaven, and my own new name." So you and I can be pillars in this temple that God is building. And it's really not so much a physical building. It's a temple, as Peter says in one of his letters, a temple of living stones. And Jesus talked about this in John chapter 2, when he commits his action in the temple at the Passover feast. He's turning over the tables of the money changers, setting free the pigeons, you know, the people were selling. He says, "Don't turn my father's house into a marketplace," makes a whip out of cords. And they say to him, the religious authorities are like, "Hey, well, who's giving you the authority to do these things?" And Jesus says, "Tear down this temple, and in 3 days I will build it again." They're like, "What are you talking about? It's taken 46 years to build this temple, and it's still ongoing, the building project. How are you going to rebuild it in 3 days? But the narrator in John says, he speaks of the temple of his body. And it's true, his physical body, which is really the temple of God, the locus of the presence of God, the incarnate presence of God. Yes, his physical body will be rebuilt, as it were, resurrected on the third day. But there's also the mystical body that he was building, the church, and you and I are part of that great temple of God that is being built. So cool to think about. We'll have so much more on the next episode of this series, Bonding with James. We continue to talk about the big three, the dream team of the Catholic Church, Peter, Paul, and James. I'm Cale Clark. We'll catch you in the next one. Follow me on Twitter, at Cale Clark, and you can get all the episodes in podcast form for The Faith Explained on relevantradio.com and on the app. See you next time.